Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
All right, welcome back once again. Yes, it's that time of the week, time for the Decibel Geek Podcast. I'm Aaron Camaro, joined as always by Chris Sinzak. How's it going, my man?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's been a fantastic weekend. You know, we got to go see the big rock show on Friday night. Man, that was a lot of fun.
It was a whole lot of fun, and we had Gene Simmons from circa 1976 was there.
Yeah, it was very cool. Yeah. Somebody won tickets to the Kiss Cruise. Yeah. Big rock show was there. Yeah. It was a good time.
It was a real good time. And
Eastside Gamblers. That's really a band somebody might be interested in checking out. They were really good.
Yeah, I talked to their singer, who also tours with Tom Kiefer's band. He's the guitarist for Tom Kiefer. And I'd asked, I was like, when are you going to get me some music so we can play it on the show? And he said they were just mastering their CD. So,
good, because I've been kind of gathering for a first New Blood episode.
Yeah,
we're ready to do something like that.
An all fresh blood episode.
That's it, fresh blood.
But, so we're, it's a little bit somber this weekend because we found out on Friday, October 10th, that Jan Kuhneman passed away.
Yeah.
And, those of you that have been longtime listeners know that we interviewed Jan. Actually, I looked it up. It was February of 2012.
Yeah.
So it's about a year and a half ago.
And you got to remember, this was back when we, were first kind of getting our feet wet doing this.
It was
a time where the sound quality wasn't as good as it is now. And I don't think the chemistry was quite what it is now. And, I don't think we had the confidence. We didn't really know what we were doing back then too much. But thankfully, there were some people out there that were still cool enough to give us a chance to come on the show.
Yeah, and Jan was a wonderful person, and I wrote it up on the show notes. I kind of did my own little memory of her. But, we could have just dedicated this week's episode and gone with another theme. But, Jan really kind of left her mark on us. We, we were, like Aaron said, we were basically just getting our feet wet. This was episode 23.
Yeah.
And, she gave us over an hour of her time and was very forthcoming, open, answered all of our questions.
Really was an open book,
Rolled with some
cool.
with some odd questions from both of us. But a super nice person, and we're really gonna miss Jan. But she passed away, I guess, after a long battle with cancer. We didn't, it was kind of a shock. We didn't know she was even sick.
Yeah, even through that whole interview back then, and I'm assuming she knew back then because they said it was a long drawn out battle with it. That, she still during that interview didn't, cry about that or say, I got this going on. She was so upbeat and so positive about everything she was doing that, there was no way we could have even known.
Yeah. So, we just
Which is a testament to her.
She's a wonderful person, and we're going to miss her. And, I was looking forward to more music from her,
Yeah, for sure.
So, but we didn't think of it. We thought there's no more fitting tribute as far as we can do than to basically give you a replay of our conversation with her.
Yeah.
Because it does cover a lot of things. It covers the beginning of Vixen when she brought the band to L.A. from Minneapolis. And,
Minnesota girl.
They struggled and, they waitressed their way up and, they had to appear in some really horrible movies. And, they worked their butts off to get to the top. And, and then she also goes into the 90s where things were lean and then also the band's reunited. So you'll hear a lot of things, but
The thing that I really, it was how open she was, and we were just rapid firing questions at her.
Yeah.
It seemed like, back then we didn't really have much control or pace, We just said, all right, we got a guest, let's go crazy.
Yeah. And
she played along so good with us.
Yeah. So, the stories are entertaining. And those of you that haven't heard the show, and it's probably a lot of you, because like I said, we've grown a lot since episode 23.
Yeah.
So, if you're hearing it for the first time, I hope the stories are good and entertaining, but, I hope you'll take it from it what we did. And that she was just a very thoughtful, caring, really nice person.
Yes.
Beautiful on the inside and the outside.
Most definitely.
So, this is our episode. We're just going to call it Jan Kuhneman Rock in Peace. And this is our talk. And we'll see you next week with a new show. tried to do some research for this because, I mean, I do remember you guys. I obviously remember Edge of a Broken Heart because that was during my you know, probably my early teen years when that came out. And I was totally into that whole scene at the time. But going further back, because what I read up on was that you formed the band yourself in St. Paul in 1980. And then I've read one report that you guys moved to, that you moved to L.A. in 81 or that Vixen moved to L.A. in 85. Which one is that?
We were already out there in 81.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And
I got to imagine the hard rock metal scene wasn't really happening in Minneapolis, St. Paul at that time. You know, everybody was on mass exodus to, to L.A. to, you know, to be a part of that scene.
Exactly.
And that would be right around the time Motley Crue was blowing up. Is that right?
You're probably right about that. Although we were still so new to L.A., we probably weren't familiar with them till a little bit later on.
As well as Crue was lucky. I mean, they were already there. You know, when you talk about bands like Vixen coming in from Minneapolis and Poison coming in from Pennsylvania, even Enough's Enough coming in from Chicago, you know, bands like that, that, you know, if you're going to make it in that time, you know, you pretty much had to be in L.A. to do it.
Yeah.
So I know.
Crue
exactly.
was lucky. They were already there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really.
And,
yeah, I mean, we had to come out there and, you know, get waitressing jobs to survive.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How poor did it get on the way up? How broke were you guys?
Oh, very broke.
Yeah.
Extremely broke. Yes.
Okay.
So when you're
were times when we were rolling pennies, and then we'd go to the store and buy a baked potato and some bread, and Yeah,
because I've heard stories about like. Blackie Lawless living in a like an abandoned warehouse, burning wood in a barrel just to stay warm. I've heard of guys in Poison living in these warehouses, and it's just like, you know, depending on groupies to basically feed them. And it amazes me the lengths that the bands went to back in those days. I don't think you'll see too many bands these days trying to go to those lengths to make it anymore.
No.
No,
you're right.
It's just not the same. So then when you guys were in Minnesota, you must have had a pretty good following in order to give you the confidence to say, hey, we got to pick this up and pack it up and move it to L.A. because we can make it there. We're doing pretty good here, huh?
We did. We had a booking agent that was getting us work, and we started out by playing like around Minnesota. Then we branched out to the five-state area. Then I remember we were going down to South Carolina and Florida, and pretty soon this agency had us pretty much all over the country, and we knew that if we wanted to make a record or do any recording, I mean, well, we had done demos in Minneapolis, but if we wanted to make a serious record, we knew we had to go to LA or New York was a possibility, but it was much more LA, I think, for us anyway.
For the scene at that time too, I think.
Yeah, but we had played around, so that we did get that experience, and we did have a good following, and the agency really helped us a lot.
Oh, okay. And in those early days, this is before the debut album came out, I found an interesting thing online, and I think I remember this from the old Showtime and Cinemax days of growing up, about this movie Hard Bodies.
Yeah.
Where you guys performed, and please tell me this is a misprint, as a band called Diaper Rash?
Nope. I'm sorry. That's the name they made us use in the movie.
Wow.
I'm glad you stuck with Vixen.
Yeah, I think Vixen's a little bit better than that. But and you played this song called Mr. Cool. Is that really you guys playing?
Yes. Absolutely.
How did you guys get tied up in this movie?
Well, a friend of ours who was an attorney, he worked at... I think it might have been MGM at the time, one of the big studios, and he got wind of this movie being made, Hard Bodies, and they needed a band.
Yeah.
And he was a friend of ours. He was a good friend of one of our first road crew from Minnesota. That's how we hooked up with this attorney. And we were doing some shows. We were living in L.A., and we were, you know, driving to Wisconsin, as a matter of fact,
nice.
To play shows in like the Midwest, and then we'd come back home to LA. We had a bus at that time, and you know, when he came up with this movie idea, and we already had some songs, and we presented him, and they said, "Yeah, okay, you know, mm-hmm. we'll use your songs for the movie. And we were getting ready to go out on this tour in the Midwest, and it was like the night before we're going to go, we still didn't know if we had the gig for the movie or not. And it was like, are we going to go? Do we have to stay and, you know, do something for the movie? And we found out right before we're going to leave, like, yes, yes, we're definitely in the movie. And so we were very excited. but we did end up having to still play some shows and then come back and shoot some scenes, go back and play some shows and come back and shoot the scenes. But mm-hmm. it was all very fun and crazy.
And your, glad we did it. And your review of Hard Bodies?
Oh, boy. Pretty funny.
Well, I've never seen it. I'm going to have to look that up. But I can imagine with a name like Hard Bodies.
Oh, yeah. It's the pinnacle of acting, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Scotty, my man, what's going? Hey, these drums are too fucking much. Out of fucking sight. Hot fucking shit.
I couldn't have said it better.
I got to go backstage and pump up one of the girls.
And I watched the clip earlier this evening just to watch it, and I'm dying to have a boogie till you puke shirt like the guy in the scene.
Oh,
nice.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, uh-huh. I had to find out the story behind that movie because there were so many interesting movies made around that time from that era. It screams 80s, but and I guess it was just a constant stream of gigging between that and 88 when you guys put the debut album out.
Yes, we were finally, after we had moved to L.A., you know, and waitressed for a while, we were finally making a living playing all mm-hmm. over the country. So that was great. We were loving it. And all during that time, we were trying to record and make demos, and we were going for the record deal for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And there were some member changes throughout that time, too.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of stress and... some people didn't want to do that anymore. You know, a couple of the original girls. And
were they all from Minnesota with you? They come out there and some of them just couldn't hack it? Or
yes. Yeah. The original band, we all went out to L.A. from Minnesota. We were all best friends. And yes. And then one by one, unfortunately, you know, different things happened where, you know,
I suppose it's kind of a stressful situation where you know, you're really kind of taking a huge gamble by picking up and packing up and going to L.A., you know, and then if things don't happen immediately, you know, some people get turned off by it and say, okay, well, this didn't happen as fast as I wanted it to. But that's a credit to you for sticking it out, you know, and really sticking to your guns and sticking with what you believed in to make it happen.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, it wasn't easy because we, you know, with my best friends, I mean, we were such a team. And then for, you know, any of them to leave, I mean, the first one was just so hard when the first girl left because of the pressure from a producer in the studio, and it was just like, oh no, our dream team is not the same. And then we, you know, would bring in a new person, and then it happened again. The lead singer, who was also the bass player, Gail, and she's actually the one that wrote that song, Mr. Cool.
Oh yeah.
She got married and just decided that, you know, it wasn't going to be right to keep on touring and playing yeah. while she was married. And so one by one, the original band was changing, and it was very hard, but I was determined to keep it going because it was my dream to have the band, you know, record and be a success and keep going. Mm-hmm. So, but it was hard.
So what was that like? You got in the studio and then the producer said, you know, this girl isn't quite cutting it. You know, she's not up, you know, not up to my expectations, and gave her a hard time and kind of like,
oh
that,
yeah, he gave know. Us all a hard time, and she just didn't like the pressure, couldn't take it, didn't want it as much as the rest of us did. And she's mm-hmm. just like, yeah, I don't need that, you know? And yeah, because now we're out in the big time and, you know, studio time is expensive and, right. you know,
and then
these LA people were, you know,
crazy. Right, because I suppose in Minnesota you're doing it pretty much on your own terms. And like you said, you know, when you get involved with record companies and stuff, all of a sudden, you know, your creativity gets taken and put into the side when they say, this is what we want and this is what we expect.
Exactly. You are exactly right about that, yes.
So how many of the original girls from Minnesota made it through to be on that first album?
I'm the only original one on that first album.
Wow. So everybody else kind of petered out and you stuck with it.
Yeah.
So then how did they just assign you new band members then, or was it up to you to find new people?
No. The whatever band we had together and our manager, we, you know, like when the first girl left, we had to find somebody to replace her. So our manager and us, we auditioned many people. Went through, I mean, you know, we were looking at the, you know, musicians wanted, and mm-hmm. just like scouring all of the musicians we could find. And let me tell you, at that time, that long ago, there were not very many female musicians to pick from.
Right.
I suppose not.
Singers, yes. We had, you know, many singers who auditioned to replace Gail, who was also the bass player, when she left, because we had to fill two positions. Mm-hmm. We had to get a bass player and a lead singer when she left. And bass players, not too many, but singers, yeah, lots of them, especially in California.
But there were plenty of guys that would have looked the part, though, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we could have gone that route. You know, but.
Yeah. Well, I think some of the guys were probably wearing more makeup than you were.
That's true. That is true.
Well, that's the way it was. You know, that was the scene at the time. You know, the glam rock mm-hmm. thing was really taking off. And, you know, I just got to say, you know, your band was even prettier than Poison.
Yeah, which was quite a feat.
Thank you. One time, I think we were in New York. We were walking down the street because, you know, in New York, that's what you do. You walk. And somebody yelled out, Poison! So they may have thought that, you know, we were Poison.
Oh, wow.
And you yell back, yeah. That's great. Tell them to take us on tour.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and on the original album, or on the debut album with Edge of a Broken Heart, obviously written by and produced by Richard Marx. Now, I read that this song was, they wanted him to write and produce this so you guys could compete with the Bangles. Did you guys really see that this way? Because I always saw that as, other than being all-girl bands, I saw nothing similar between
not
the two
really,
of you.
Not really, no.
I've never heard that before. Where did you hear that?
Wikipedia, of course.
Oh, wow. No. We had completed recording the first album, or so we thought. And, you know, just like you were saying a few minutes ago, the record company came in and said, oh, no, we don't hear a single on there at all.
Yeah, isn't that a classic cliche? Yeah. We don't hear a single.
Yeah. We don't hear a first single, so your album is not finished. And we're like, oh, okay. But they said, but they already had, like, release dates kind of lined up and, you know, things were already planned. And so they wanted a hit single or a single, first single, immediately. So our manager also was managing Richard Marx at the time, and Richard Marx, you know, is a great songwriter. So our manager went to Richard,
and that was kind of before he broke as a solo artist, right?
He had had some success. I don't know.
I think he was,
how much
he was just getting going at that time. I think.
Yeah, he was probably just getting going at the same time, you know. And he was also on the same record label, and so our manager also wanted us on EMI, and it was EMI Manhattan at that time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, our manager called Richard up and said, can you write Vixen a single, like, right away, like tonight, overnight? And
wow.
Richard, of course, came up with one, and he also got Fee Waybill to work on it.
Oh,
him.
The tubes, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Awesome.
And so then we went in and rehearsed it, learned it real fast, and the record company's like, yeah, that's it. So go in the studio and record it. And Richard, that must have been part of his deal, that he wanted to produce the song that he had written. So that's how it ended up.
Yeah, because that Richard Marx, man, he had a formula for hit after hit after hit for a while there back in the 80s. I mean, that guy, when it came to writing hit singles, you know, that were going to be radio friendly and get a lot of spins on MTV, you know, he had it under control.
Yep.
Actually,
I know. So thank God our manager went to him for that song for us.
I think he actually lives here in Nashville now, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
Oh, yep. Really?
Yeah, I believe so. He could write songs for the rest of his life and be fine.
Good.
Sure.
He could have one for us tomorrow morning, apparently.
Yeah.
Can you tell him to give us a call?
Hey, sure.
Vixen's ready for their next big hit single.
That's right.
We'll have the sequel. All right.
Yeah.
Well, then in the 88 and 89, you toured with Ozzy, Scorpions, and Bon Jovi. Is that correct?
We toured with Scorpions and Ozzy, and we did one festival with Bon Jovi.
Oh, okay.
I got to ask. I mean, I've been just dying. The whole time when I thought about doing this interview, I've been dying to ask, what's it like for some, you know, for a young girl from Minnesota to all of a sudden be on tour with Ozzy?
Well, you know what? Off stage, he's a sweetheart. And another thing, my parents came to one of our shows, and I think it was either Nashville or Memphis. I don't remember which one, when we were on tour with Ozzy. Mm-hmm. And my mom, to this day, she will pull out a picture of me and Ozzy that she took backstage because she's so proud. So, you know, it sounds like...
If mom only knew.
Yeah, like she would have been, you know, maybe not...
She was a big Sabbath fan, right?
A big what?
Big Sabbath fan?
Yeah. Exactly. No. But, you know, so Ozzy backstage is, you know, a lot different than what people think he is on stage. So,
did you always hear the crazy stories of all the wild things that Ozzy does? I mean, was there ever anything he did that just blew your mind that, you know, this is the Ozzy of legend kind of a thing?
No, not really.
Is that the answer of I'm debating if I should really say this or not?
No. I think he... I'm trying to remember now. We were watching off stage. We had already done our show, and I think he might have dumped water on the monitor guys or something. He did something a little crazy one night, but... You know, that's just part of his show.
Sure.
And, so no animal sacrifices or anything?
No, I don't think he was doing that on the tour we were
on. I'm really let down. Oh, man.
It wasn't snorting no lines of ants or anything crazy like that. You know, because you read the Motley Crue book, you know, and he's doing all these insane things, you know, and I don't know if maybe he was a little toned down by that time or if it's just all kind of legendary.
Oh, wait. This will settle it right here. Was Sharon there?
She was.
That's it.
That's why.
See, there you go.
He was on his best behavior. Mama was watching.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just as we are with our wives.
Right, exactly.
That's why they're not here.
Uh-huh.
Well, and then Rev It Up comes out after that. How was Rev It Up a more enjoyable experience than the debut?
It was.
Mm-hmm.
We had just one producer for the whole entire album of Rev It Up, whereas the first album we had the three different sets of producers. You know, Richard Marx, David Cole, and Rick Nair were one team, and then what is his name? Spencer Proffer.
Oh yeah,
produced a few of our songs too.
Quiet Riot's guy.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we recorded at his studio, and he had a completely different way of recording than the David Cole, Rick Nair team, which, you know, did the first part of it. So anyway, by Rev It Up, it was nice to just have one producer because it was more consistent. And also, this producer on Rev It Up, Randy Nicholas, he allowed us a lot more freedom than the first record. Song-wise, just part-wise, everything. And so it was more relaxed, and I think we probably had a little more time, whereas the first record, the record company was on such a strict budget and time budget as well. We were nervous wrecks going in there because it's like, okay, you get 5 minutes to do this take, and it's like, okay, you know, wow.
Don't make a mistake.
You know, the Rev It Up was a lot more relaxed than that.
Yeah. You got to always think about, too, with the, they call it the sophomore deal, you know, where you come out with that second album. You guys had a big hit single. You know, was there a lot of pressure at that time saying, hey, we've got to come back and we've got to come back with an even bigger single than we had the last time? I mean, was there a lot of pressure with that?
I think so, but we were so busy and doing so much promo along with the recording and the writing of the album that we were just too busy to even recognize that that might have been what was going on.
Right.
But, of course, we wanted it ourselves to be, you know, as good or as big as Edge of a Broken Heart. And, you know, there was some trouble with the record company. How Much Love was the first single off Rev It Up.
Mm-hmm.
And our manager was fighting with EMI, and How Much Love was going up the charts, and then all of a sudden it didn't get the promo that our manager was trying to get for it, and it just kind of stalled. And it was like, wow, you can just see how the politics and the business can just, like, really kill your career, you know?
I suppose. I mean, you can write the greatest song in the world, but if you don't get the right push behind it, you don't get the right backing on it, you know, it might not go anywhere.
And part of the reason, I think, was because, you know, somebody at EMI was pissed off at our manager, and they just like, well, we'll show you, kind of thing. You know, I mean, I honestly think that that's what happened.
Well, you know, and that's the business and the politics of it, too. You know, like I said, you can write Stairway to Heaven, but if you, you know, if nobody's out there to hear it. Exactly.
Rubbing our last two brain cells together. This is a Decibel Geek Podcast.
Listen to the Decibel Geek Podcast on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and webOS phones with Stitcher. Stitcher's smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Hi, this is Chris Holmes Vodka Bottle, and you're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
So then we go from, then you go on tour and you do, to tour with Deep Purple, and I remember you touring with Kiss on that Hot in the Shade tour.
Yeah.
That was the,
that was fun.
Yeah. I was going to say, it must have been pretty cool.
And I was,
oh my gosh, we were like, wow, we get to play with Kiss. That was amazing. That was awesome. Yeah.
And I was highly let down because, I saw that tour in Nashville and you guys weren't on that leg. And instead of getting to see you guys who looked nice, I had to look at Mark Slaughter and, and deal with those guys the whole time. I mean, Kiss was great, of course, but yeah, so was it pretty amazing getting to tour with those guys?
It was totally amazing. Yes, it was unbelievable. I wish it could have lasted longer.
Yeah.
But we had a blast, and they treated us very nice, very well, and respected us. And,
Gene Simmons wasn't trying to get in everybody's pants?
Oh, you know, he was a big flirt.
Of course.
Yeah, definitely a big flirt, yeah.
And obviously with our connection to you from Loretta, obviously you have good memories of Eric Carr from that time.
Yes, I absolutely have great memories of Eric. Mm-hmm. He was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Very sweet guy.
And what was it like touring with Deep Purple at that point?
that was fun, too. And, you know, they were pranksters. I remember on our last show, they they did some, you know, pranks backstage and everything, but and that was in Europe, so it was different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when we toured with Kiss, it was in the States, and we're familiar with all the places we're going. But touring with Deep Purple over in Europe, you know, we're going to some new places that we hadn't been to, and I mean, that was exciting, but yet it was just a whole different world, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were you guys getting good response in Europe?
Yes, we were, very much. And Deep Purple treated us very well, too. And
because I got to imagine at that point in time, too, Deep Purple was a lot bigger in Europe than they would have been in the States at that time, right?
I think they were, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Europe seems a lot more loyal to what they like. Not that I'm downing America, but America's real flighty, it seems, with rock and roll in general. I mean, because Europe, that, you know, if they like a band, they hold on to that.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
That's true.
And then, you know, I
just... noticed that too. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even not even just Europe. I mean, just other countries in general, you know, yeah. Even like they talk about Japan, you know,
mm-hmm.
Japan, how big, you know, some bands are just, you know, may have been years ago. Like, you know, and I hate to talk about like eras, like say, oh, this band's from the 80s, that band's a 90s band. I don't like that. You know, I think a good band is a good band. It doesn't matter where they came, when they came out. You know, for example, nobody, you know, ever, never hear anybody say, oh, the Beatles, that's a 60s band. You know, no, nobody ever says that, you know, or Zeppelin, oh, that's the 70s, you know. But then you get the whole stigma of, oh, that's an 80s band. You know, oh, that's from the 80s. You know, I always thought that was funny, where to me, a good band is a good band, and it doesn't matter when they came out. But here in the States, it's kind of like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's very, you know.
We want to tag everything with a label.
Exactly. It's everything is very labeled.
And then they love you for a little bit, and then all of a sudden, you know, you can't get arrested. it's like they, can change, you know?
Yeah. And then, if you don't mind me getting into this, because I've going over your history, it's unusual.
Yeah, it gets kind of funny.
It gets a little convoluted here because you guys, the debut album lineup splits up in 91 and this was right after doing the MTV Unplugged was right before that.
Pretty close to the breakup, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So that lineup splits up and I'm just going to go ahead and take it as the pressures.
Well, you can say anything.
We were talking about this before because I remember I worked on radio when the tour was going on with, it was supposed to be Rat, Union, and Vixen. And at that time, you know, I remember that Tangerine, I think, was already out at that time. You know, but nobody really talked about, you know, what was really going on in Vixen, you know. But then when the show came to town in central Wisconsin, it ended up being Rat and Union, but Vixen wasn't there. And they said, you know, at the time, they said, well, Vixen has just broken up. You know, it was like just happened. You know, there's
so
a lot
of. So was that like 98?
That would have been around, late 90s. Yeah, I'd say late 90s for sure.
Okay, so it definitely wasn't the 91 breakup that we had.
That's where I'm confused because if Tangerine was the album that came out without you, you know, did they come out with an album without you, then you sue them, and then you guys get back together after that? I mean, is that how that works?
Yeah.
Obviously, Vixen is your band. I mean, you formed it out of all the original members. You're the only one that was on that original album, you know, and you get a bunch of other, you know, musicians. I don't want to say replacements because everybody becomes a part of the band. But, you know, at this point, then, you know, that's where I was confused, you know, where this other album comes out without you on it. But then you guys are back together, but then you're split up again. I mean, is that. It's confusing.
Yeah,
let me see if I can make some.
Please connect these dots.
It's tricky.
Okay. Around 1997, I got a call from, I think it was Roxy at first, and, you know, we had been broken up for a long time by this time, from 91 to 97. And she had been talking to Janet, and they were saying, hey, you know, let's see if we can go do a tour, you know, let's get back together and do a tour. And I said, okay, I'm open to it. And we were having talks and going with it. And I don't think Cher was interested at that time, but the three of us, Roxy, Janet, and I were, you know, talking about doing it. And I remember this one conversation I was having with Roxy, and I said, well, we better, you know, call one of our keyboard players from years ago or you know, talk to somebody about playing keyboards. And she said to me over the phone, she said, no, we're not going to have keyboards on this tour. We're going to have another female guitar player. And I said, well, then that's not a reunion. I said, no,
right.
I'm not going.
Right.
So they didn't like that answer and they went anyway. And then nobody called me. They continued like a year later, and Janet and Roxy started working on Tangerine with this other guitar player, Gina. And, you know, they will tell the story that they asked me to be part of that record. And it's like, no, I was asked to be part of a reunion tour the year before.
Right.
That then, wasn't really a reunion.
No, that you guys already behind my back were trying to have this other guitar player in there and not use keyboards. And I'm like, well, we have a lot of songs that the keyboards, yeah, you know, like Crying and, you know, they're important.
Why
like, I'm not.
Right.
Yeah. Why so dead set against keyboards?
Because they wanted to have another guitar player.
Well, you
instead,
know, here I, you know, and I can play the devil's advocate here. You know, I'm not a big fan of keyboards in hard rock and heavy metal music. On mm-hmm. the other hand, you know, I do see your point absolutely, because the keyboard was very instrumental in what you guys had done with songs like Crying. And you know, to not have that, I would think the fans would be disappointed because, yeah, you know, it'd be maybe a more rocked out version of the song. But it's, if you're talking about a reunion tour, you want
exactly,
you
and
wanna,
it was like, well, this is
yeah,
totally different. This isn't a reunion tour, so this isn't what we started out talking about. So no, I'm not interested. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that seems kind of like diluted, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So then, they, at that point, they decided just to carry on without you.
Mm-hmm. And then about a year later, I believe it was '98. You know, was around the time Tangerine, and I heard about it from a friend that had heard it on the internet, and the internet was like new back then. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I didn't have a computer, but somebody had heard something that there was going to be a new Vixen record, and I'm like, what?
Huh.
And sure enough, I found, you know, researched it and found out that they were doing, making this record, and that's when it's like, well, they don't really have the right to do that. So that's when I sued them.
Right. And it sounds
and
to me,
won.
You know, you had the rights to it. Yeah.
They did actually release Tangerine, obviously,
right?
But they got sued over it, and I won. And after I won the lawsuit, I was working with this manager, and he said, well, okay, so you won the lawsuit now. Do you want to make lemonade out of lemons? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, would you ever consider, I mean, this was like probably another a year had gone by or something, mm-hmm. you know. So some time had gone by after the lawsuit, and he said, would you consider working with them again? And I said, maybe.
Right,
and he
I
went
can
to
imagine.
Them and asked if they would consider working with me after I had sued them, you know, and they said, maybe.
Wow.
So we all got together in Detroit, the manager's hometown, and that's when we started talking about, you know, going out and doing a tour, and by that time it was the tour for 2001.
Okay.
With Vince Neil and Rat and Slaughter. And so we all agreed to do it, except Cher. Again, she was doing something on her own with her Bubble, her band Bubble.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So she was not interested. So Roxy, Janet, and I, and a different bass player, mm-hmm. Pat, went out on that tour in 2001.
Okay.
I know it's kind of confusing.
I'm just trying to keep up. And then that was called the Voices of Metal Tour, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
But unfortunately, it was a really hard, rough tour. A lot of travel with, we were in a van and, you know.
I suppose at this point, you know, you're thinking this is now 2000. You know, the whole climate of the music industry and the music of what was popular and what is popular is two very different things now. You're talking about, you know, a time where you're on tour with Vince Neil and Slaughter and it's Vixen, in a time where the radio and the record industry is dominated by bands that are considered like grunge bands and alternative bands, where, you know, metal bands were kind of looked on as, you know, and I hate to say it because I'll never agree with it, but they were kind of looked at as has-beens at that time.
Or,
right.
Know, novelty.
Right,
or a novelty act, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
right.
I can imagine that's got to be pretty tough going from, you know, having a great hit single over the years, you know, touring in the tour buses, out there with Ozzy and Kiss, and all of a sudden now you're playing fairgrounds and stuff in you know, little towns in central Wisconsin.
Right. It was different, definitely. And we had to travel, you know, halfway across the country to, you know, be able to do these shows. So you're right. It was, you know, it was difficult times, and we couldn't hold it together. You know, it was falling apart.
So was it just the pressure of everything with the all the travel and everything? And then obviously, you know, it's amazing that you guys made up to do a tour to begin with.
Right.
After a lawsuit, much less anything. So obviously all that travel and being in each other's faces, I'm sure that just built up more and more pressure as it went on, right?
It did, and a couple shows fell through, you know, so the money was even less than we thought. And this manager that had talked everybody into doing this, he was my manager. So I was kind of like, well, okay, whatever, whatever happens, happens. But he had led the other girls to believe that, oh, no way would we be in a van. We're going to have a motor home or a bus or something nice, you know.
Oh, he sold it up.
He did. And he truly believed that himself. But then when the shows, you know, didn't all come through and the money wasn't there, there was no way that we were going to be able to afford that. So, you know, we started out in a van. He was like, well, this is going to change. We're going to, you know, move up to a motorhome or whatever. And we were never able to.
Yeah.
So they definitely were not happy, the other girls.
Right.
But because it was my manager, like I said, I was kind of like, okay.
It all fell onto you too then, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
It did. And it was just falling apart. And, you know, people were not happy. And nobody was getting any sleep. And
just a rough time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at that point, then,
on and, yeah.
Do they just decide to up and leave?
No. I mean, there were, like, you know, arguments and fights between, you know, a couple of the girls and the manager. And it was not real fun. It was not, just not working.
It wasn't like touring with Kiss and Ozzy.
No. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It was not.
I mean, I can't imagine how tough that's got to be, you know, to be, you know, a big-time selling band. You know, you're selling tons of albums. Your video's playing all over the place. Everybody knows who Vixen is. And then at that point, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, and it stinks because the music climate, and maybe, you know, it comes back to the fact that, you know, America is so flaky sometimes with, you know, what's popular, what's not, you know, and things come, things go. You know, it's got to be kind of heartbreaking to get out there and know that, you know, look at the crowds you played in front of with Ozzy and Kiss and Deep Purple, and then you're out there in the van again, you know. And when you started out, you know, it's like, it's almost like full circle where you started out in the van, you got to somewhere, and then you're back to the van again. I mean, it's got to be kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You got it, exactly. And, you know, comparing to what we were going through in 2001 in the van, I mean, we were in the van with our luggage and guitars, and we were like sardines packed in there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and the last time we had gone out together as a band and toured, we had a big, beautiful bus. We had people carrying our luggage, you know, carrying our guitars, and, oh, can I get this for you? We had, you know, our own rooms, and now all that was changed, you know, like sharing rooms and three to a seat in the van with guitars right behind your head. And, you know, just, yeah, so it's a lot different, a lot different.
Now, we know you love the Decibel Geek Podcast, but right now I'd like to take a moment to turn you on to our friend's show, the PWAshow.com, talking about Corey H. and D-Brew. Now, these guys cover a wide array of subjects, and you never know what you're going to hear these guys talking about, but I can tell you this, a guarantee that it's always going to be funny and it's always going to be entertaining.
That's true. If you want to hear all the new talk about Occupy Nashville, adult onesies, and a whole bunch of crank calls to Walmart employees, this is the show for you. Corey is kind of a hippie-ish guy who likes to go to Whole Foods and pay twice as much for groceries as everyone else. And D-Brew is more of a laid-back conservative dude. I think he works for the police, so hopefully he's not going to find my stash. But check out the PWA show at thepwashow.com.
Broadcasting from the rock and metal mecca, Nashville, Tennessee.
What in the hell?
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast.
So then, but then the other girls end up leaving the tour, and then Jenna, Lynn, and Kat come in and finish the tour. Is that correct?
Yes, they did. And, you know, to this day, it's, to me, it's like a miracle happened.
I mean, yeah, I was curious about that. I mean, how did that? How does that work when half the band leaves in the middle of a tour? I mean, how, and you got to do it quickly, right? I mean, how do you quickly scoop up these musicians? And like you said, it's lucky that you ended up with such great ones that stick with you through the years. But how originally did you find them so quickly?
Well, our keyboard player on the tour, he was also our road manager, stage manager, driver, everything, right? Mm-hmm. So when it was falling apart, and he's a good friend of mine, and so when it was falling apart, he and I, we were talking, and we just said, well, you know, wow, it really sucks to just call it quits and go home. I wonder if there's any way possible to find replacements and finish out the tour. Mm-hmm. So he called a mutual friend of ours, and actually I had played with this drummer when the Vixen had broken up. I played with a guy group, and it was called Population 361.
Mm-hmm.
You probably never heard of that. Mm-hmm. But so he called this drummer who I had played with as well and said, do you know any female singers? And he goes, yeah, hold on a second. And because he's also a lawyer, and so is Jenna, he calls Jenna on the other line while he puts Eden, our keyboard player, on hold and says, hey, Jenna, would you have any interest in being the lead singer for Vixen? And she's like, yeah, okay, yeah. What are you talking about, you know? Then he comes back on the phone with our keyboard player and said, I think I might have somebody for you.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was... That's a true story, how Jenna, you know, came to be in the band. And we also put, or Eden, our keyboard player, he put an ad out, musician service or something. And Lynn was living in Florida at the time. And it just so happens that she had sent, I believe she had sent a package when the band first broke up to our management or something and said, hey, if you're looking for a bass player, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a female bass player, whatever. So somehow she got wind that we were now looking for a female bass player. She gets on the phone with Eden, and he says, well, we're holding auditions. You know, we have like a 2-week window before we have to go back out. So she flew from Florida to California, and she was awesome, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, oh my gosh, this is really happening. And, Kat was actually, let's see, I think we had gone through a couple of drummers before we came to Kat, and we were getting down to the wire. There was a good friend of mine in L.A. that was going to do it, and she, almost to the last minute, she rehearsed with us, learned the songs, and all of a sudden it was like if she was going to go out on the tour, she was going to lose her very good day job, and so she couldn't go. And we're like, oh! Now what are we going to do? You know? And Lynn happened to know some other female players who, you know, knew somebody who knew somebody who knew Kat. And they're like, okay, we sent her down. She, you know, somebody got her a tape one afternoon, and she learned a handful of our songs, came down and, you know, rehearsed with us. And we're like, oh, she's great. I think this might work. So like 2 days later, we had to be back out there for the next show, 2 or 3 days later or something. We only had a couple rehearsals with Kat.
That's amazing.
And yeah.
How to form a band in 2 weeks.
Yeah, no,
I know. It's crazy. And then we all get along so great. It's like amazing, you know?
And did you get any resentment from the other girls that had just taken off at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they gave you a hard time for them. Oh, really?
You know, at that point, it's like, hey, you know, you walked.
Yeah,
you know, you chose to leave. These other girls don't have a problem riding in the van with me. You know, we're making it happen no matter what, you know. And they should know that because Vixen was your baby from day one, you know, that you weren't going to let it go. You know, so they chose to walk away. You know, you didn't. And here you've got some other players that are coming in that want to be there. You know, that's got to be kind of refreshing once you go back out on the tour after that 2-week break, you come out with one band, you come back in with a whole new one, and everybody's appreciative to be there. I mean, how much better was the vibe then after that?
It was a lot better because, you know, they didn't have all the expectations, you know, because they hadn't been on the tours in the 80s in the big, beautiful bus and the...
Right.
You know, all that. So they were very eager to, you know, be team players and go out and try it and do it.
Okay, so.
And it was funny. I mean, the looks of the the guys we were touring with, they're like, what is going on? You know, because there were other breaks in the tour where we'd go home for a weekend or 4 days, 5 days or something and come back and get back on the tour, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, whoa, you guys look different.
Yeah. Did I drop too much acid over the break?
But they all gave us a lot of support. That was great.
Oh, wow. All right, well, so we go from, and that's the lineup that you're still currently working with. But
yes.
In the middle of all that, then VH1 calls you up and shows up and says, "Hey, let's get these girls that hate each other's guts and put them back together again."
I know. I mean, what is the deal? Yeah.
So yeah, it's like the Godfather thing. Every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you saw it or
if
you just heard about it.
I love it. It was my favorite one of those bands reunited shows.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because I always wondered, I was more on the peripheral of rock music at the time. I was in college and I was doing lots of things I shouldn't have done. And so I sort of lost touch of being really in depth with what was going on in rock music. So when I saw it, I was like, holy crap. I was like, Vixen. I was like, I totally remember this. And so I had wondered what had happened to the band. And boy. When the meeting between the four of you, the first time you guys got back, you could cut the tension in the air in my house.
Oh, I know.
So, I mean, yeah.
I mean, a lot of times you see these reality shows and a lot of it is perpetuated. I mean, that was pretty real, huh?
Oh, yeah.
It was. I mean, there were some spots where they edited it to look worse than it was. Like when Janet and I were in the room and they made it kind of look really tense when we were alone in the room together,
mm-hmm.
and they chose to make it more dramatic,
sure.
You know, which they're going to do because it's TV.
Right.
But
artistic license.
What really happened was that, you know, when we first, Janet and I first were the only two in the room, and, you know, we hugged and we talked a little bit, and, you know, we were being filmed the whole time. But then after about 15, 20 minutes, we ran out of stuff to say. And that's what they chose to show, you know, looking like we're like,
awkward silences.
Yeah. Awkward silence. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I could. Yeah. Oh, I watched it and I was just like, and that meeting part that I was watching, I was like, this
was real.
Yeah. I was like,
that was real when everybody was like, you know, kind of yelling back and forth or not yelling, but, you know, like.
Mm hmm.
Telling their side of the story, you know.
Well,
that was real.
And I was thinking initially, this is not going to lead to a performance. I was sure of it. I was just like, they obviously hate each other, so I was just like, this isn't going to work out. But it was fascinating to watch, and you guys actually put on a good performance. But like, how was it? How did the other girls react when you went to them and said, "Hey, the original band's going to do this TV thing"? I mean, how did they feel about that?
Oh, they were fine with it because I said it's a one time only, and that's what it was.
You went into it knowing that.
Yes, and I don't think any of the four, you know, Janet, Cher, Roxy, or myself, would have done it if they would have said, "Okay, you have to play together for the next year." You know,
yeah.
They, you know, the way they approached it, it's a one time thing, so it's like, hey, why not?
Yeah, it's good exposure anyway, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know,
so the current bandmates, they were cool with it. Oh, they're
okay.
Fine.
You know, we're big Kiss fans. We're always, you know, talking about different things in Kiss, and we always wonder, you know, how bad must that have been for, like, Bruce Kulick and Eric Singer when all of a sudden Peter Criss and Ace Frehley show back up.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and they're
right.
Like, oh, well, we're out on our asses now.
We're just going to do this one unplugged show, guys, I promise. It's not going to lead to anything.
You know, and in the back of the mind of the other band members, you almost got to wonder if they thought, oh, man, that's that. You know, they're putting the dang VH1, putting the band back together. We're all out on our asses now. But that's cool that they knew that you were confident enough in them and their abilities and the good time that you were having working with them that they had nothing to worry about.
Okay, and you've put out material with this new lineup here. And what's the best place to go to hear the new material that you guys have put out?
It should be on our website, vixenrock.com.
Vixenrock.com. Okay, and I have to ask this because this has been brought up over the last week or two that I've noticed as you remember, John Parks from Legendary Rock Interviews interviewed you not long ago. And you know what I'm going to ask you about? The there's a Cher Peterson has been pushing to try to reunite with you again with the other girls. And there was a comment put on John's comment thing under your interview, signed by supposedly all three of them, saying we think the time is right. We'd love to hear back from you. Do you have any response to that?
Well, I already responded.
Oh, you did.
Because, you know, I've been asked that question many times in the past few years.
I'm
many
sure.
Times.
I imagine, yeah.
And my response was only maybe for a short time, like a couple years ago,
mm-hmm.
Because I was working with that same manager at that time that had put us back together in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do it again. And we started to talk a little bit about it a couple of years ago. You know, I talked to Janet and Roxy, and they, again, didn't want to work with this manager because they had such a bad taste in their mouths from the 2001
tour. This guy is going to put us back in the van.
right. And we just couldn't come to any kind of agreement. And the thing is, the manager, he had also talked to Jenna, Lynn, and Kat a couple of years ago and said, look, this could be beneficial to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you go along with it or whatever. But it just didn't work out. It was all back to the same stuff. And it was just like, you know what? No, I'm not going there. And so I've been approached a few different times in the years since then. And most recently by Janet, just,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a month ago or so. And I already gave my response, and I said, well, thanks for reaching out to me, but I'm too busy with my current bandmates to consider doing a reunion. And apparently they didn't like that answer.
Well, I suppose not.
So that's how they, you know, Cher got this other page started or whatever to do a...
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to see it because I thought, you know, after the VH1 thing and, you know, like, because I even watched some of that earlier today, and even on that, Cher herself was saying, I look at this as a good send-off to this lineup of the band. And it's like, I can kind of see your point of view of where it's like, well, you know, I've kind of put that to bed now and I want to do it this way, which, you know, you're totally entitled to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can kind of see both sides of things. I mean, if you look at the difference between, let's say, the, you know, now compared to 2000,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
if you're trying to go out on tour with the original members in 2000, it's really not going to get the response that it would get today. You know, today
uh-huh.
you're looking at, you know, if you reunite with the original girls that, you know, with the rest of the ones that were there towards the beginning, I guess.
First album.
Yeah, first album. We'll say first album. You know, it's considered more of a nostalgia thing nowadays where these
uh-huh.
bands from back then can reunite and it becomes a nostalgia thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got to make the decision. Now, do you want to be a nostalgia act? Or do you want to carry on and be creative in your own vein of music, doing what you want to do with the band that you feel most comfortable with? And, you know, personally to me, you know, and I know a lot of Vixen fans probably won't like this, but I say kudos to you for sticking to your guns and doing what you feel is right. Because you formed the band Vixen. You know, who knows? You guys could go back out on tour tomorrow and it could be the same thing again. It could be Vixen breakup number 18, you know? Why bother? You know, why bother with it? If you're happy with what you're doing and you're happy with the band you've got and you're comfortable with it, I say stick with it and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. I really, really appreciate you saying that.
I mean, I'm probably the only one, but...
Well,
I just don't think it would do, you know, our current lineup any good if I went back and did the reunion with the other girls, because then maybe the fans would say, oh, well, you know, then it's always got to be the old
right.
lineup.
Yeah. It gets confusing. But,
don't Bruce Kulick those guys, you know? Don't do it. I mean, if they came in and helped you out in a time where, you know, you really needed a strong band, you know, and it sounds to me like you've got one now. You know,
yes,
and maybe technically it's not the classic lineup that everybody expects, but hey, you know what? Go out there, produce this new album, and blow everything you've done before away. You know, come up with the best album you can, and then who can question it? Right?
I love that. Yes, yes.
Yes.
Right on. Yes, exactly.
Gosh darn it, you didn't know.
You didn't know you were going to get an Aaron Camaro pep talk, did you?
That's it.
No, but I'm happy. I love it. Thank you.
Good deal.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.